Now we turn to God's Word this morning. We turn to the book of Matthew again, Matthew chapter 2. Matthew chapter 2. We start reading at verse 1. Reading through verse 12, with a text coming to us this morning from verse 11. Matthew 2, we start at verse 1. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born king of the Jews? We all saw his star in the east, and we have come to worship him." When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and teachers of the law, he asked them where the Christ was to be born. "In Bethlehem, in Judea," they replied. "For this is what the prophet has written, 'But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least among the rulers of Judah, for out of you will come a ruler who will be the shepherd of my people Israel.'" Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, "Go and make a careful search for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me so that I too may go and worship him." After they had heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen in the east went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. Catch verse 11. Let us read it together. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and of incense and of myrrh. Of all the traditions that we have celebrating Christmas, one of the dearest, of course, is this custom we've grown into of giving gifts. It's logical. But with the giving of gifts, it's key that the gift you give is appropriate. Well, probably that's part of what makes gift-giving so difficult at times. The appropriate gift. So you know categorically some things are not appropriate. If you've got a little child in the family clan that's not yet celebrated their first birthday this Christmas, you're going to get a gift that is appropriate for that little child. If it's a little girl, you're not going to get her a Barbie doll if she's not yet outgrown her teething ring. If that little child is a baby boy, you're not going to get him a motorbike if he can't stand up yet. Likewise, if you've got a construction worker in the family, you're not going to give that construction worker a nice, beautiful
silky scarf.
And if you did for a gag gift, I guarantee you he's not going to wear it to work. And likewise, if you got an elderly aunt or mother in a nursing home, you're not going to give them a compound hunting bow. You want to give the appropriate gift. Well, then, if you're going to give an appropriate gift, what would you give as a gift to someone you love more than anyone else? Equate that. What would you give as a gift to the Christ? The more important the status is that a person holds in your family life, the more important you want that gift to match something to do with their status. So, well, a couple months ago, we happened to be in a northeast corner of Columbus, Ohio. That's kind of a yuppie town called Dublin. And in this yuppie town, alongside of a yuppie mall with all the expensive stores, there was also this one special store that imported foods from all over the world. And walking through that special store, seeing all these different things, there's in the deli section on a block a huge wheel of cheese. Came from one of those creameries. I think it was a Wisconsin creamery. Huge wheel of cheese. It was about 15, 18 inches thick. It must have been pushing 3 feet in diameter. And I immediately thought of a little detail. Not exactly sure when. I think it was about 80 or 90 years ago. Some American creamery owner, man, was friends with the president in the White House and decided he would give a gift appropriate for that president and had him sent one of those giant wheels of cheese. The president was impressed, and ever after, the man occupying that White House has been called the Big Cheese. But now, if you are going to give a gift to the Queen of England or the King of Denmark, if you would give a gift to the Queen of Netherlands, of whom the report is that she is the richest woman in the world, or the King of Saudi Arabia, who has his wealth plus his oil fields, you would want a gift appropriate to the status. But now you've got a problem. If the Lord you love is the King of Kings and the Lord of the universe, how can you possibly give a gift appropriate? Two parts to the text. Your worship and your gift. Don't you love this text? I have to confess, as often as I've read this text, as often as I've studied this text, there's new stuff in it absolutely every time. Read this. What happens? Verse 9. After these wise men have come to Jerusalem, after they've talked to King Herod, after King Herod has conferred with his legal experts in terms of the Old Testament law, after he gives them a report, they go out of Jerusalem, they're headed south towards Bethlehem, and what's what they see? The star that has they had seen in the east is ahead of them. Phenomenal. But how can it be? It says there in verse 9, the star went ahead of them. It says at the tail end of verse 9, it stopped. Now put your think cap on and try to explain it, would you please? Stars don't move. As God has placed those stars in the galaxies of the universe, from our perspective, even the galaxies that are so far off, according to the astronomers and the astrologers, they're moving, but that movement is so infinitesimal from this perspective, they don't move. So the North Star that was in its position when Columbus sailed the ocean blue, 1492, is exactly there. It doesn't move. So what was this star that moved? And the skeptics and the non-Christians would flippantly say, oh, that was a comet. And you'd say, put on your think cap. This is a modern world. You know how the solar systems work. So this past summer there was a comet named Elenin. I've spoken about him before. He came flying through our solar system. And the scientists all had the trajectory of that comet all plotted out. They had it totally figured out exactly where it was going to go through our solar system. And they had it calculated, I think it was along about September 23rd in there. They had it calculated that it would be to its closest point with planet Earth. And they had it figured out that it was going to go through our solar system, warp around the sun, and go flying out into space. But this huge comet, 47,000 miles in diameter, five times bigger than planet Earth, one thing they had not calculated well enough was the gravitational pull of the sun. And when it came past Earth, it got a little bit too much of that gravitational pull and got sucked into the sun. And October 4th, Elenin was dead. The star? It was not a comet. It could not be. It's scientifically impossible. A comet does not stop and start. Stop at Jerusalem, start up again, and stop over a house. Impossible. Furthermore, think of where these wise men came from. Ancient Chinese records say that the ancient Chinese astronomers saw the star in its rising, 4 BC. Then if in these caravans, there were also Chinese astronomers. They'd been on the road. But what sort of road did they have to follow? Mind you, they were traveling, chasing that star at night. Mind you, the traveling by camels. Mind you, when you travel at night, it's a simple thing. You simply reach down in the corner of the dash, you flick on the lights, and you got headlights on the vehicles. Last camel I've seen does not have headlights. They got two humps, but not two headlights. So these camels have to travel by night. They have to travel by night, these wise men, and they're making, what, just a few miles per night as they're trekking this star all the way across the skies? But consider the territory. China, if they came from there, Gobi Desert, Mongolian Desert, if they went north of the Himalayas, that would mean it had bypass Afghanistan, but they would hit Kazakhstan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan,
Turkmenistan, then into Iran. But what kind of territory is that? That whole stretch has mountains, and you know what it's like when you travel through the mountains. Sometimes you go this way, sometimes you go that way because you're going. The star leads them, though, through those mountains all the way across the continent of Asia. Sometimes they're going west, sometimes they're going northwest, sometimes southwest, sometimes north, sometimes south. They're always going, returning west. Have you ever seen a comet do that thing? Impossible. If there were wise men in the caravan that came from as far south as Cambodia, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand, Burma, they would have to go a different route. What was that? It was no star. It was no comet. What was it? You can only come to one conclusion. The God of the universe had an angel like an Olympic runner carrying a torch, and that torch was to guide them, stop and start, even if necessary, whatever the direction. And now, rather than going west, they're going from Jerusalem to Bethlehem, and it's due south. And it stops over the precise house. Knock on the door, and there he is. Back to the text. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. Verse 11. Coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Absolutely. A king of kings who's coming into the world is declared in the heavens and has guided them to an exactly correct house. In all of that commotion, they know this is a cosmic king of the greatest significance. And notice they use a certain word. Or the text uses a certain word here. They worshiped him. Please do not overlook that word. You and I, especially in the Christian community, will use that word until we beat it to death. We talk about worshiping like we talk about shopping, or fishing, or hunting. Worshiping, the Greek word, ready for it? Proskoukeion. It means to endure in such fashion you're willing to lay prostrate down in a position where you can kiss the feet of the other. Muslims don't do that. When Muslims answer the call to prayer five times a day, they spread their prayer rug, they point it toward Mecca. They kneel down, but they stay on their knees with their posteriors in the air as they touch their foreheads to the ground. This goes far beyond that. To lay yourself down in total adoration, like the Samaritan leper that was healed, Luke 17:16. You understand that? Like the women when Jesus rose from the dead, lay themselves totally down, fondling and wanting to kiss his feet. Like the elders around about the glorious throne in heaven, 24 elders all laying down prostrate before the throne. What does this mean to worship? It means to totally devote yourself in absolute adoration. Can you imagine when Mary and Joseph saw these wise men come into the house, and they must have taken turns, each laying down and worshiping this child of theirs. Mary and Joseph must have had eyes like saucers. But you understand, he was the king of the universe. And these astronomers from the east understood that too. But then what about a gift? The text goes on. And they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold and frankincense, incense, and of myrrh. They opened their treasures. So they brought their treasures with them. They didn't have credit cards. They didn't have debit cards. They didn't have checkbooks. As they're traveling along those many miles, they brought their treasures with them. They opened their treasures. Imagine this now. They're opening their treasures. Read the text very carefully. And they presented him with gifts. Not to Joseph. Not to Mary. To him. But remember, Christ child is only about a year old. What do you think the Christ child would pick out? Have you ever witnessed a lady going through a checkout lane with a one-year-old in the shopping cart? That lady's hands are busy. She's got to take the stuff out of the cart and put it on the... She's got to monitor this. She's got to watch the prices. She's got to write the... She's got to watch that little child. What's that little child doing? Sitting behind that shopping cart. The little child is looking at all the candy on this side and all the trinkets on that side. The little child is... Of course. What did these wise men do? They laid the whole treasure open. Here, Lord Jesus, pick whatever you want. Oh, there's a problem. For if you show him in your treasure 20 gold coins, you don't want to give him 15 pennies. What do they give? Three gifts. Gold? Sure, of course, that's the kingly gift. It's still a kingly gift yet today. What has happened to the prices of gold? The price of gold in the last 5 years? Gold is the metal of our wedding rings. Gold is the metal of the kingly crown. They give to the Christ gold. Mind you, the Lord was planning to finance a trip into Egypt, and he had that being taken care of in advance. They give to the Christ child gold because it is the prophetic finger pointing that he will be King of Kings. It's the kingly gift. Second gift. Frankincense. And again, it makes you scratch your head. In this translation, it's only listed as incense. Frankincense, where does it come from? A certain frankincense tree grows very well. It's a type of balsam tree. In northern India. For when that balsam tree seeps sap. Well, they do that on purpose. Those frankincense hunters, gatherers, cut little gashes in the bark of the tree on a slant with their jackknives, only so long. And out of that gash, the sap seeps, whitish, comes to the bottom of the gash, and then in a dry climate, it hardens. 3-4 months later, they come back, and those frankincense tears are hardened to the consistency of rock salt. And can be sold as a spice. But no. Exodus 30, verse 34. says that frankincense would be ground into a powder and put into the anointing oil for the high priest. So here, these wise men didn't know it, of course, but as they give to the Christ child this gift of frankincense, it was pointing directly forward that he would be the great high priest, far surpassing Aaron and all that lineage, a high priest after the order of Melchizedek. Beautiful. And there's a third gift. And the third gift is myrrh. Where does myrrh come from? But again, you got prophecy in the text. And that song we just sang picked right up on it. Myrrh came from a certain desert bush growing north of Saudi Arabia. But it was called in local language the bleeding bush, because when one of those little twigs got broken, that yellowish sap would come to the edge of the gash, would form a tear, yes, and would start to harden. But as it would start to harden, it would turn color from yellow to orange to bright red. Anyone seeing that bush with those little tears there, bright red to dark red, call it the bleeding bush. And after it would go from dark red, just like a scab, it turned black. And you could grind that stuff, when it turned hard, you could grind that stuff in such fashion that it would form a nice powder, a powder and a spice. Some people called it a medicine of the highest expense. Well, the wise men didn't know it, because they were just giving something very expensive to the Christ child. But the Bible tells you, John 19, verse 39, that on the day that Christ died and Joseph of Arimathea was taking his body down, who met him? Nicodemus. And what was Nicodemus carrying? 100 pounds. Of myrrh and aloes. And as they were wrapping the body of Jesus in the grave clothes, they took 100 pounds of this powder, sprinkling it, dumping it on his body, because it would help against any stench. So here at his cradle, the wise men are pointing a finger prophetically to his death. A kingly gift? Yes. A priestly gift? Yes. A prophetic gift? Oh, no. Flip that coin over. Oh, yes. Because without that death, you and I perish. And because of his death, we live. So the question this morning is not, how far did you travel? 100, 400, or 4,000 miles? Maybe further than that? The question is not, how bumpy was the camel ride? The question is your worship sincere? Is your heart sincere? Is your love sincere?